Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the war in Ukraine, and we'll touch on recent developments and upcoming developments. Among them, the long-awaited approval of a new U.S. Aid and weapons package, more talk about talks, Putin's new term, which starts tomorrow, and the broader issue of how to deal with Russia, how the West should deal with Russia. Would a policy of containment make sense? And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Sam Green, Director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, or CEPA, and a professor at the King's Russia Institute at King's College London. Thank you very much for joining me, Sam.
Thanks, Steve. Always a pleasure to be with you.
All right. It's great to have you on the show again. It's been some time. Let's talk first about several aspects of Russia's war against Ukraine. I'm going to try to mention a few developments. We'll go through them. One, of course, is the passage late last month of a new package of U.S. aid, including about $50 billion in weapons and other military aid, after about 6 months of debate and delays in Congress. It comes at a time when Russian forces are making gains on the battlefield, largely because of the dwindling supply of Western weapons, and U.S. weapons in particular. With some analysts, and I believe Ukrainian military leaders as well, saying the situation for Ukraine on the battlefield may be the worst it's been since shortly after Russia launched the full-scale invasion in February 2022. So, Sam, I just on the issue of the U.S. aid and how that's affecting things or may affect it in the coming weeks and months, I'd just be interested in your thoughts.
Well, I mean, look, to a certain extent, I think you've already answered your question. I mean, the saying goes, right, that it's better late than never. But there comes a point at which things are so late, right, that the actual difference between late and never is severely diminished. And I think that this is one of those situations. I don't want to suggest for a minute that it was a mistake to pass this aid. It will save lives. It will help Ukraine hold through. There was an interview and some statements by Jake Sullivan just within the last 24 hours or so, suggesting that what this was meant to do was to help Ukraine hold the line until it could mount a counteroffensive in 2025. So this is a reduced level of ambition, and with that a reduced level of hope. It exacerbates the challenges that Ukraine is facing on the front line, and exacerbates the political challenges of trying to increase military mobilization and conscription and volunteerism within Ukraine. It gives succor to Russia. Right? I think they will look certainly at how long it took to pass this supplemental. They may have in fact been hoping that this wouldn't have been passed at all. And if that's the case, I think it's good news that they turned out to be wrong on that. And it will hopefully cause them to reflect. But they could be forgiven for thinking that, depending on how things go in November, certainly it'll be very difficult to see another supplemental coming up before then, and this is designed to get us through those elections. But that it certainly may not become easier to get support and aid to Ukraine after November 2024. And so, as much as Sullivan and others might be looking towards a counteroffensive in 2025, first of all, it's not clear what the state of play in Ukraine will be by the time we get to the fighting season in 2025. And it is far from clear that the West will continue to give Ukraine what it needs to get there. That level of commitment really needs to be re-upped.
All right, thanks, Sam. And you mentioned this sort of the issue of mobilization, volunteerism in Ukraine, and you know that as you say, I think that's kind of a big factor that Ukraine passed a new law on mobilization just I guess a couple weeks ago, but it's a bit unclear, you know, how that is going to play out and how, you know, how much that will be able to change the situation. Another thing that is happening that's related to the war is kind of what I would say is maybe a new wave of talk about talks, discussion of whether Russia and Ukraine might negotiate an end to the fighting at some point, and whether that's a good idea and whether it's realistic. Among other things, there have been comments from Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, and the deputy chief of military intelligence, Colonel General Vadim Skibitsky. I believe these were both last week, suggesting that negotiations might eventually happen. Though, as far as I know, at this point, Russia has made no indication that it's prepared to negotiate on anything other than its own terms. Still, the mention of the very mention of this by Ukrainian officials is unusual. You know, I think people are saying that that points to, you know, I guess an increased possibility that this could happen at some point. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that as well, Sam.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that it's as unusual as it might seem, right? We have a peace conference in Switzerland later this summer. We had a peace conference last year in Saudi Arabia. Ukraine obviously wants to negotiate on its own terms as well it should. There is no inherent reason why Ukraine should be able to should be forced to sacrifice territory and human lives just to end this war, particularly on somebody else's schedule. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility, first of all, that that you would come to the point where, you know, Russia might decide that it is time to cut its losses and negotiate some kind of an orderly withdrawal. That is one way in which wars end, and so negotiations can happen in that way. It's also, you know, unfortunately, I think, given the track record of Western support, not beyond the realm of possibility that the Ukrainians themselves could decide that, in fact, their ability to continue recapturing and liberating their territory and the populations who live on that territory is such that some sort of a negotiated outcome would also be more desirable than continuing to trying to fight it out. At the end of the day, that's a decision that the Ukrainians are going to have to make. Any attempt to impose that on them from outside would only lead to really a political chaos and breakdown, and would end us all in a position, I think, considerably worse than what we're facing. But nobody has denied from the very beginning that negotiations can be a way out of this if those negotiations are serious. In other words, if those negotiations recognize Ukraine's right to territorial integrity and sovereignty, its right to defend itself, if they recognize Russia as an aggressor, if they bring some degree of justice for Ukraine, and if they can provide reasonable guarantees for Ukraine's security going forward. That certainly is not on the table, but the point of negotiations would be to get that on the table, right? So it's not, I think, wholly unreasonable, again, for the Ukrainians or for anybody else to say, look, you know, if people want to be serious about this, we're willing to engage in an open-ended process that would eventually get us there. Right now, of course, you know, all of the indications, certainly from the Russian side, are that have no reason to be serious about this. They feel at the moment that they can win on the battlefield. The Ukrainians do not feel as confident on the battlefield as they would like to be going into a negotiation process if they were to come to that conclusion. And so, you know, unfortunately, the fighting continues.
Okay, thanks. And I just wanted to ask I guess, a specific follow-up question on that. You know, some of the people, I'm not saying all by any means, but some of the people who kind of call for negotiations, who say Ukraine should or kind of put it as Ukraine should turn to negotiations quite soon. And they kind of suggest that kind of leaves out, I guess, the Russian stance, the Russian public stance in terms of, even if Ukraine were to say today, and this is just me saying this, okay, let's talk, and sort of the understanding being that Russia would keep control, at least for the time being, of territory that it now controls. The Russian public stance, as far as I know, has been, we made these four regions plus Crimea part of Russia, and they will be ours, whether it's through talks or through further war. So how does that, I mean, is Russia kind of bluffing when it says that? Is there a chance that they could, back down on that? I mean, some people do say, of course, that Putin can spin almost anything as a victory.
Yeah, well, I'm one of those people, right? Putin can spin just about anything as a victory. He's shown himself to be able to do that. He's given himself a tremendous amount of rhetorical flexibility. That said, I think it would be very difficult for him to negotiate away territory that he has argued is now constitutionally part of the Russian Federation. And more importantly, I don't think that Putin has the ability to pivot away from geostrategic conflict with the West. It is the cornerstone of the Russian political system at the moment. It's the cornerstone of his legitimacy and his ability to control both the elite and the street. It is the cornerstone of the functioning of the Russian economy. To the extent that the Russian economy is growing, it is only growing because of the war effort. And so I don't see a counterparty in Russia that has an interest in this. And I think this is one of the aspects of the Western conversation that in some parts has begun to suggest, has been suggesting for a long time, frankly, that we ought to be seeking a negotiated solution. What that means, of course, is pushing Ukraine into a negotiated solution. What that really means is the US negotiating with Russia over Ukraine's head. But leaving aside the moral aspect of that and sort of the geostrategic aspect of that, it imagines a Russian position that I think is illusory, right? It imagines that what this is at the end of the day is a war that Russia is fighting because it's interested in, relatively minimalist goals in the service of its own national interest. And I don't think that we actually have any evidence that that's the case, right? This war has, in fact, diminished Russia's national security from anything that sort of standard international relations theory would consider a rational standpoint. It hasn't yet brought Ukraine into NATO. It has certainly brought NATO into Ukraine. It has reduced Russia's options around the world. It has diminished its economy. It's diminished Russia's flexibility, again, politically and geopolitically. It's costing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. It's created a brain drain. I mean, we can go on and on in the ways that this war has diminished and impoverished Russia. And yet it is something that the Russian leadership very clearly feels it needs to continue to pursue. And I mean, it would be nice, I suppose, if it were possible to give Russia some kind of a security guarantee and they would decide it was time to turn around and bring the troops home. But again, there's no indication of that. And so, the only thing that is gained by a negotiating process when we are imagining the other side's interests is a diminishment of support for Ukraine. And I think without something on the other end of that equation, that's rather unconscionable.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Sam. And some of parts of your response, I think, make a good transition to the last question I have about things that are happening in connection with the war. And that is, Putin starts a new 6-year term tomorrow on May 7th. That comes after, of course, he's declared victor by a huge landslide of the election in March, the three-day election in March. And the inauguration, as it has been in past years, this will be his fifth term. Inauguration is sure to be kind of a pomp-filled ceremony in the Kremlin. But what I'm wondering is whether you think anything will change, either in terms of the war or the situation in Russia itself, as Putin's new term as president gets underway.
You're asking me to predict the future, which is sort of my least favorite pastime. The reality is that Putin's campaign, to the extent that he ran a campaign for this presidential election, was about the absence of change. And so I think he is probably going to try to make things feel as steady state as possible for the vast majority of ordinary Russians. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do, right? He has to keep the economy on the rails. He has to keep the war effort on the rails, which means managing a difficult sort of balancing act between, you know, keeping workers in the economy and extracting some of those workers for military service, as well as, you know, the potential that when you do try to extract large numbers of workers from military service, you create emigration as people leave the country to avoid that service. Managing that without making some sacrifices, either for the economy or for the war effort, or in terms of political control to make it harder for people to leave the country, is going to be a little tricky. I think we may see some indication of a little bit of a shakeup in government that wouldn't be unusual, partly because people, you know, do eventually sometimes retire, decide they want to move on to other jobs. We saw, you know, just the other week with the arrest of the Deputy Minister of Defense, Ivanov, that, you know, there may be increasing pressure on Shoigu, depending on how, you know, this summer's offensives go from the Russian perspective. We might see, you know, more pressure on the military leadership on Shoigu and on Gerasimov in order to at least show that, you know, if they can't make progress on the battlefield, that they will, make progress on the political field at home. I think we ought to also keep an eye on public support. Public opinion is difficult to measure these days in Russia, and it's difficult to understand exactly what may be driving it. But if we come back to 2018 and look at, you know, sort of the last time Russia had a rally around the flag, right? This massive uptick in support for Putin after the annexation of Crimea in 2014, the illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014, right? That came crashing down in the summer of 2018, and two things had happened at that point. One, or three things really had happened at that point. One was you had the World Cup in Russia, which gave people something to be, you know, happy and enthusiastic about that wasn't attached to the Kremlin, and there was a little bit of a letdown when that ended. You also had the pension reform, which Putin had supported and which was broadly unpopular, and that's usually what gets blamed for sort of the end of the rally around the flag that summer. But you also had, you know, Putin's inauguration into, another term in office. And, you know, the enthusiasm, whatever enthusiasm had been whipped up during the campaign, dissipated. And you tend to get a little bit of buyer's remorse as people settle in and think about, okay, now what? And what does my life look like for the next 6 years? And if you are looking, you know, with any degree of care at what's going on in the Russian economy, it's not hard to see why people feel like they're okay right now, but you begin to project that right now, you know, 6 years down the road. And it's hard to see reasons for optimism. And it's easy to see the ways in which the political decisions being made by the Kremlin are constricting the choices that people have, right? So in the past, even when people weren't doing well, you know, economically, they could be optimistic because they had options, right? They felt that they could, get a new job, they could increase their education, they could move to a different part of the country, they could do something, right, to increase their welfare. Broadly speaking, they didn't expect the state to do them any favors. They expected to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. But the war and the way that the government is running the economy and increasingly inserting the state into the economy reduces the ability of ordinary Russians to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. At the same time that, most of the things that the Russian state is doing is actually impoverishing them at the very least through, increasing inflation and costs of living. And that can create, again, a challenge that the Kremlin will struggle to resolve. I'm very far from predicting that, that we're facing some kind of an explosion. But I think that the challenges, again, that the Kremlin is facing are increasing. They are increasingly overlapping, and the liquidity that the Kremlin has with which to solve these problems, both political liquidity in terms of its ability to sort of, pivot and change tack, as well as financial liquidity, the ability to pour money on things, is diminishing.
All right, thanks very much for that helpful look at what's. Let's transition from what's going on inside Russia and what may happen inside Russia to broader topic of kind of how the West should be dealing with Russia. As you mentioned, it doesn't look like Putin is ready to give up or slow down his kind of mounting confrontation with the West. So I'm going to ask you about, and I'm going to let you do the talking on this more than anything else, I guess, because I'm out of my depth even more than on other issues. I'm referring to containment, a familiar term for almost anyone who has studied the Soviet Union or the Cold War, but a term that I believe is often misunderstood. The word conjures images from decades ago. But it's being talked about more recently as the West struggles to figure out essentially how to deal with a Russia that is now very aggressive, to put it mildly. Sam, you wrote a blog a few weeks ago addressing whether it might be time to return to what you called the beleaguered idea of containment. And in January, you played the leading role in a SIPA report on containment. Would you mind taking us through this a bit, essentially? What is containment, and is it something that the West should turn to now?
Well, having edited and co-authored a report on it, I think, yes, I do think it is something that the West needs to take seriously. I'm struggling to see another option. But let me take a step back. I said a moment ago that I don't like to predict the future, but we did in that SIPA report say a little bit about what we think the plausible sort of range of futures for Russia is. And it's not entirely implausible that there could be a democratic opening at some point that does cause Russia to pivot to a very different kind of both domestic and foreign policy. But we don't see that as terribly likely. The reality is that the decisions that led Russia to war in the full-scale war in 2022, to a partial invasion of Ukraine in 2014, to the invasion of Georgia in 2008, in fact, to the intervention in Ukrainian politics in 2004 with the attempt to ensure that Viktor Yanukovych inherited power from Leonid Kuchma, is the result of what my co-authors and I believe is a fairly long learning process on the part of the Kremlin about what its interests are. Right? Now, I'm not justifying these interests. We're not saying that these interests are, sort of objective, but they are the interests that the Russian power elite and its current regime perceive. And these really include three things. One of which is the ability to weaponize foreign policy for domestic political power. Right? So, to manipulate conflict as a way of marginalizing your opponents, of concentrating power, of really keeping the political system and the political economy entirely focused on you. That's fairly straightforward. Putin is very far from the only person in the world who plays that game, but he plays it very successfully. And so, some degree of conflict in the world is useful. Now, against that backdrop, right, you have two, I think, more fundamental things. One is that the Kremlin came to believe by, say, 2005 or so, right, when Russia again was inserting itself really powerfully into Ukrainian politics, if at the end of the day not successfully, that it needed to dominate as much as possible the entirety of the post-Soviet space, of its former empire, politically, economically, and militarily. This is important because Russia feels more comfortable if it's surrounded by states that are governed more or less the way that Russia is. And to the extent that those states, in fact, end up being pulled into the orbit of the European project, really the European geoeconomic project, right? The European common market and its sort of broader neighborhood. To the extent that large economies, particularly like Ukraine, begin to be governed in ways that are closer to the European Union than closer to Russia, it closes down avenues for the Russian economy to seek liquidity, right, to operationalize control in its former empire, but also puts a lot of pressure on Russia itself to reform and to become governed in ways that are, again, closer to the European Union, to govern its own economy and competition within its economy in ways that are closer to the European Union. And that leads to pressure on Russian politics. At the end of the day, it's a rent-based system, it's a patronage-based system, and that requires a very different mode of economic government than we have in the European Union. And so the ability to defend its domination of that space through military means, if necessary, is important. As Russia began to do that, particularly after 2014, with again the militarized intervention into Ukraine to prevent it from again integration with the European Union through an association agreement and a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement, it found itself coming up against the institutions of Western power in the world, particularly not just political institutions and military institutions like NATO and the European Union, but the general way that the global trading and financial system is constructed, which allows the West to impose sanctions at a very real cost on Russia. And so Russia has, again, through all of these three things, developed an addiction, a political addiction to geopolitical conflict with the West, at least to some degree of conflict. It has a dedication to political, military, and economic dominance in its former empire. And it has a commitment to undermining the structures of Western power in order to, again, survive that conflict with the West and to remove impediments to its domination of its former empire. Right. So the West faces in Moscow a not a situational conflict, right, but really an embedded in a long-term durable conflict, very much in the way that George Kennan was describing in the 1940s when he wrote his long telegram and was beginning to argue for a policy of containment with vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, right? The idea that, whether we like it or not, we are facing a military an enemy that cannot be, subjugated militarily, right? We're not going to occupy the Soviet Union, we're not going to occupy Russia, and we're not going to be able to put in place a government that is more amenable to us, and we shouldn't try. But also, that really can't be persuaded, right? No amount of diplomatic engagement is going to create a change of heart and a change of mind in the Kremlin. And it's highly likely that that these sort of ideas about Russia's national interest and its foreign policy will be inherited by whoever takes office, just the same way that Brezhnev inherited at least a degree of Russian foreign policy, a large degree of Soviet foreign policy from Khrushchev and his successors from him. Whoever replaces Putin is likely to operate broadly in the same mold again, because this is not Putin's idea. These are not things that develop just overnight ahead of this war, right? So that's the impetus, I think, for looking at containment. You mentioned misconceptions, and I think that most people probably associate containment with a lot of disastrous foreign policy making by the United States in the middle to latter part of the Cold War, right? This idea that we needed to be inserting ourselves militarily into conflicts around the world to prevent communism from spreading, sort of domino theory that if one regime were likely to take power, say in Vietnam, right, that it would cause a cascade of communist takeovers around the world that really would diminish American power in the world. And you know that cost unconscionable amounts of blood and treasure for the United States and for its allies, and really did not make the United States any more secure. And I want to be clear that that's not the argument that I, or I think most of the other people now in Washington who are also, you know, arguing for containment, that's not the argument that I think any of us are making. In fact, containment begins from a place of humility, right? As I was saying, Kennan looked at the Soviet Union and said, look, we cannot defeat the Soviet Union. We should not try to defeat the Soviet Union. We cannot persuade them out of conflict. Our interests are fundamentally not aligned. And so some degree of conflict is inevitable. So what we need to do, even less than contain the Soviet Union, sorry, even more than contain the Soviet Union, what we need to do is contain the conflict. We need to create structures that make a militarized escalation of conflict anywhere in the world so untenable and so unconscionable and so costly that we can reliably expect our adversary, in that case the Soviet Union, in this case Russia, or eventually China, to always choose a negotiated way out, to always choose a peaceful resolution. That is the basis of the argument that again that we at SIPA and a number of other people around Washington are making now. It is to return to the roots of containment, not necessarily what it turned into down the road.
All right, thanks very much. I mean, I guess I'm afraid to ask, but maybe you could follow up with kind of a short explanation of what, you know, what could be done to make that happen. Maybe that's
Sure. Well, I mean, it begins, first of all, with the recognition that that's what needs to happen.
right.
And I think that requires a shift in the way that the United States thinks about foreign policy. If you look at the current national security strategy, you know, it recognizes that Russia is a current threat, but it really sees China as the enduring threat, and sort of suggests that, you know, we can sort of solve this problem in Ukraine and then pivot and not have to worry about Russia anymore. I think part of the argument that we're making is that, in fact, you know, containing Russia is going to be much more of a long-term challenge, and it's not, in fact, a distinct challenge from, you know, keeping the relationship with China from escalating in its own right. In other words, if we are able to demonstrate that, in the Russian case, a conflict with the United States is costly, that is a lesson that hopefully Beijing would take on board as well. Now, in terms of specific, you know, policy responses, I don't pretend to have a laundry list of all of them. All of these are things that people should debate, and I'm sure that, you know, there are definitely a lot of very intelligent, wise, and creative people out there who are working on this. But some of the things that we put out in the SIPA report, you know, include first and foremost a focus on deterrence, right? There is a military element to this, right? And that deterrence is reinforced in two ways. One, frankly, is by winning the war in Ukraine, right? If Russia is allowed to come out of this with anything other than an incontrovertible defeat, it will be much harder to communicate the message to the Kremlin, or indeed to Beijing, right, that there are real consequences to be borne for this kind of adventurism. The second part of deterrence, obviously, is to ramp up both military defense capacity, defense industrial capacity, and deterrent capacity, particularly along the eastern flank of NATO. to show that, in fact, we are filling the gaps in defense industrial production that we've seen over the course of the last 2 years of the war in Ukraine, and that we are putting that material to good use along the eastern flank so that Russia should think, three or four times before getting involved in some kind of an adventure anywhere else along its western borders. Another aspect of it that we identified is really focusing on political and economic solidarity across the Atlantic. Right? Russia should not have the illusion that it can drive wedges amongst the NATO allies and between Europe and the United States. Doesn't mean that the allies always have to see eye to eye on everything, right? But Russia needs to see a durable commitment in key capitals, if not in all capitals, in Europe and in North America, to containment and to again this strategic deterrence of Russian aggression. And in that respect, it's heartening to see that, here in the UK where I am at the moment, that there is a bipartisan consensus that, it's likely Labour will take over in government later this year, and their policy will be indistinguishable on Ukraine from that of the Conservative government. We've seen, recent statements from Macron, which should also give pause to the Russians in terms of their ability, again, to drive wedges. And so that, again, degree of contain of solidarity and commonality is important to a strategy of containment. And then the last element that we identified really is challenging, again, Russia's domination in the post-Soviet space. I want to be very clear, we're not talking about militarily challenging Russia's domination. Nobody, at least among my co-authors, is suggesting that we should be starting or instigating or supporting wars to supplant Russia. But it's about giving societies and giving economies options other than Russian domination, making it clear that, for example, if there was a change of government in Belarus, that they will have a European future. Making it clear that if Georgian civil society continues to hold its government to account, that Europe will make good on the promise of a European future for Georgia, that the promise of a European future for Moldova is made good on. There is not a European prospect for Central Asia, right? But there are opportunities to engage economically with the countries of Central Asia and socially with the countries of Central Asia so that they are not left seesawing between Beijing and Moscow.
All right. Well, fascinating comments. It's great to hear so much detail about this idea. And we are going to wrap it up there. Thanks very much for joining me, Sam.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Steve.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Sam Green, Director of Democratic Resilience at SEPA, and a professor at the King's Russia Institute at King's College London. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.